At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello there, cultists. How are you? Struggling even now with those New Year's resolutions? Don't worry, we got your back. Yes, another year has come and gone, which means a new season of cult classics. I trust you had a pleasant holiday period in which we wring whatever small portion of joy from life we can before entering the drudge that is January. Hopefully we can keep you company and give you a small bright start to the month. And we're starting this year off with a bang. Several, in fact, as a series of Kurt Russell-prompted explosions ring out across what used to be the Big Apple. As this year, we're kicking off the show by taking a look at one of John Carpenter's most acclaimed movies, the 1981 classic Escape from New York. Yes, it may seem a little on the nose discussing a US dystopian hellscape, especially considering the date this goes out, but I assure you, this was planned a good while ago. We're just not that adept here on the show. As always, I'm DK, your host for this year's foray into the cinema of the weird. But as always, I'm not alone. Joining me this time are a couple of guests that I would say need no introduction, but I'm going to do so anyway. First up, we have my cult classics partner in crime. It's his job to make the show and me sound good, so if you have any problems, blame him. And if you think these things sound unprofessional now, just imagine what they'd be like without his influence. It's my editor, Nick.
Hello there.
And how are you doing today, fella?
I'm doing very well. And quite excited to be talking about another John Carpenter film. I had to come back for this, really. The last one I did was about a year ago, They Live. And before that, I did Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, it has become something of a tradition, you joining me for the Carpenter movies. As you say, Big Trouble in Little China. And then pretty much 12 months ago now, They Live. Is it just that you like these movies?
It's interesting because that would make me seem to be some big John Carpenter stan, which I'm a big fan, but not so much. No, it's just these particular ones that you've chosen are the ones that really resonate with me.
Right. You'll not be coming back for Ghost of Mars or anything like that.
Are you going to do that? I might.
I really am not, but I was just throwing that out there. I mean, you normally, other than that, you normally don't do these. You learn very quickly that you felt more comfortable behind the scenes and behind the mic. So I do consider it an honour that you joined us for this one. So
yes, we'll see if it's an honour or a curse.
Well, glad to have you with us either way. Yeah, if you didn't hear us talk about either Big Trouble or They Live, you're always welcome to check them out. They're still available. I'll put the link in the description. Yeah, and speaking of, our next guest first appeared on last season's review of Clive Barker's Hellraiser, where he offered both his expertise and a damn good chat too. And that really was a great one. So I urge you to check that out. Again, I'll put that link in the description. But we're going to be welcoming back author, screenwriter, friend of cult classics, and all-around genuinely nice guy, Mr. Paul Kane. Welcome.
Hello, are you all right?
I'm not too bad. How are you? Did you have a good holiday season?
Pretty much. Same as usual. Kind of thing. Ate too much, drank too much, I suppose. Same as everybody else.
Yeah. Well, thanks for returning for this one. We did have quite an in-depth chat last time, which I am truly grateful for. Nick edited that and he loved every second of that. And that's definitely not always the case. Isn't that right, Nick?
I'll pass on the second part of that question. But yeah, I would highly recommend going back and listening to that Hellraiser episode. Oh. It is genuinely, genuinely fantastic and genuinely inspiring as well.
Oh, thank you.
It was fascinating hearing about your writing and your involvement with the subject at hand and your work. You did have several things in the pipeline when we last spoke. So how have things been with you these last few months?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I can't remember now, it's been so long ago, but one of the things I talked about, I think, was that book, that novel that was coming out, that was my first novel that I, proper novel that I wrote, called The Wet.
Yeah,
I found the manuscript on my hard drive, had a look at it, and it didn't seem horrendous, so I thought, well, as a curiosity, I'll put it out, and it seemed to do, you know, people seemed to like it, so there was that. There was a collection called The Roads Less Traveled. The Wet came out through Hellbound. The Roads Less Traveled was through Crossroad Press. Yeah, so they're the last two that came up. We had a folk horror anthology out over last summer, which I think I talked about as well, didn't I? With people like Adam Neville and, you know, John Conley in it, and Jen Williams, and people seem to enjoy that as well. So and a Christmas crime anthology just before Christmas, Death Comes at Christmas, which you can still get now if you you know, I know it's January, but you could buy a present for next year or for this year's Christmas, I should say, coming.
Have you got anything new on the writing front? Anything exciting plan for the year ahead?
Yeah, a few things. I mean, I never like to kind of, like, I don't count my chickens or anything about when stuff's coming out, but there should be a reissue of Arcana, which was the kind of magic horror novel from a few years ago. There should be a collection of short scripts coming out, which are all my films that got made, with the story alongside the script, and even some scripts that weren't written by me, so that should be quite interesting. I've got one called Bleeding Hearts, which we're hoping to launch around Valentine's, which is kind of like warped and twisted love stories. I'm trying to think what else there is planned. I'm working on I'm editing the sequel to The Storm at the moment. If you love your monster films and kind of giant monsters, and, you know, books like The Crabs and The Rats and stuff like that, the first one is like a... is a homage to all those kind of things, and sort of Stephen King as well. And this is like the sequel to it, so I'm doing like a sequel to it at the moment. So yeah, it's all good stuff. We got the Romantasy anthology has just been announced by Titan, which is Secret Romantics Book of Magic, I think it's called. So yeah, that's out over the summer as well. So that was a really interesting book to put together. It's got people like Tasha Suri in it, Olivia Blake, again, Kelly Andrew, lots of good stuff in it. Really, some really great stories in that. Catherine Arden. Other than that, I can't really say. It's a bit too dim and distant to sort of see.
I can't believe how much stuff you and Marie have, you know, get out there. You're incredibly prolific. You end up writing things quicker than I can read things. So
pays the bills. That's it. You're going to pay the bills. So. But yeah, anything and everything. We're just, you know, I'm a jobbing writer. I've been a jobbing writer since the 90s. So, you know, hopefully put out some good material and entertain people. And that's the hope.
Well, great stuff. We do. We look forward to seeing some of these things. Well, we might have to get you back once you've done that script and find out more about it.
Absolutely. So
once again, thanks for taking the time out to join us. We guarantee this episode is going to be a lot less intense than last time. We're just going to talk about the film, so don't worry about that. You're under no pressure.
I don't remember it being intense last time. So I had fun, so yeah.
Yes, folks, for our first go-around this season, we'll be looking at Escape from New York, which is an American independent science fiction action film co-written, scored, and directed by John Carpenter, starring Kurt Russell. Now, set in the now retro futuristic world of 1997, the now prescient, watch this space, film sees New York's Manhattan Island, which has been converted into a maximum security prison. Former Special Forces and federal prisoner Snake Plissken is given just 24 hours to go in and rescue the President of the United States, taken prisoner by anti-government insurgents, after which, if successful, he will be pardoned. Now, Carpenter penned the idea for the movie in the mid-1970s as a reaction to the Watergate scandal after his success with 1978's Halloween. He had enough clout to begin production independently. Deborah Hill and Larry Franco, longtime collaborators with Carpenter, produced the film, which was co-written by Nick Castle, who played Michael Myers in the Halloween movie. The production was filmed in and around St. Louis, Missouri, on an estimated budget of $6 million. It was released in the US on July the 10th, 1981, and received both positive reviews from critics and was a commercial success, grossing more than $50 million at the box office. It was also nominated for 4 Saturn Awards, including Best Science Fiction Film and Best Direction. It went on to become a bona fide cult classic, so much so that the inevitable sequel followed in 1996, also starring Russell and written and directed by Carpenter. And the movie can currently be found on various streaming platforms, dependent on your location, as well as being available to purchase in various physical formats. I'm much too young to have seen this in the cinema. I think the first time it was on my radar is on one of my regular trips to the video rental store. Okay, I'm not that young. With my dad, where I saw the poster with the Statue of Liberty's head, what I've got in my avatar, in the middle of the street. And that captured my imagination. I remember really wanting to see it, but recognizing that it probably, well, at that age, wasn't my type of movie. It was a couple of years later that a friend got a copy of the soundtrack on vinyl and would listen to it incessantly, which again, with the images on the back of the sleeve, sparked my imagination. So it was always there for a good few years before I caught it late night, I think, on the BBC. It was great to finally see and enjoyed it, but all the same, I do remember being disappointed that the Statue of Liberty thing was not in the movie itself. Damn movie posters back then. Yeah, how about you guys? What was your first experience with this one? And I'll come to you first on this one, Paul.
And I used to watch a lot of genre stuff when I was growing up with my dad. He got me into the genre with Doctor Who and like Incredible Hulk and things like that. So it would have been, I mean, I'd have been about, I don't know, 8 when it when it came out. So I wouldn't have been old enough at all. But I think my memory of it was, we used to watch like stuff on Saturday nights. My mum would just be looking through catalogues and things, and me and my dad had watched genre stuff like Hammer films and like any kind of horror films and things like that. And I think it was on ITV. I saw it with my dad. I would have been about 11 or 12 or something whenever it came onto TV. And that's kind of my abiding memory of first seeing it and just being sort of, didn't know anything about it, obviously, just being blown away by obviously Snake Plissken, and you know, just like, wow, this guy, you know. And I think we just kind of watched it, me and my dad, with our sort of mouths open and just were stunned by what have we just seen kind of thing.
Oh, great stuff. So you got happy memories of this one?
Absolutely, yeah. And still happy. I had happy memories of seeing it last night when I rewatched it again.
So, all right.
Yeah.
What about you, Nick?
Yeah, like many of these films, it's lost in the mists of time when I first saw it. I don't have specific memories of the first time, but it would have been similar to you guys. It would have been on late night TV. But yeah, it would have been on a little 14-inch portable in my bedroom, watching it sort of probably mid to late 80s, making enough of an impression on me to, you know, want to see it again. And so I bought it on VHS and DVD, and that's actually how I rewatched it again this time around, on the, I think, a special edition DVD. It was released quite a number of years ago now, so yeah, but no specific memories, similar experience.
So would either of you say it's one that you rewatch with any regularity?
I don't really watch it that frequently. It's one that, you know, it's in the back of the mind. It's like, oh, Escape from New York is a classic, which it obviously is, but don't necessarily actually put it on again. It had been quite a while since I'd seen it, and rewatching it for this show. And yeah, glad I did, and cursing myself for not doing it more frequently.
How about you, Paul?
I mean, fairly often. I mean, it must have been a couple of years ago, I think. I remember watching the I've got the same DVD as Nick.
Lovely. The way.
Yeah, very, very nice edition of it. And it's got the, I don't know if you've ever watched it, but it's got the original beginning,
yeah,
where he robs the bank and such.
Yeah, I was discussing that with Nick earlier today. I think it's a fascinating little scene that I do like it.
I can see why it got trimmed, but it is kind of a nice little scene to the robot's kind of funny at the beginning.
Yeah, I was telling Nick about that at the time. It probably looked really cutting edge, but now it's oh dear.
Yeah,
it's something from Rent a Ghost.
Yeah, it's not great, that robot. It just slows up getting to the cutting to the chase, really, doesn't it? I suppose, but.
Yeah, it is worth a watch for any fans. Yeah. It does put like a slightly different slant on Plissken, and I've read that Carpenter didn't like that because it kind of made him a little redeemable, and he just wanted a straight up anti-hero.
I think as well, you kind of have this scene in your head when he arrives at the penitentiary. You kind of have this scene in your head of how it all went down and how he got caught, and I think in my mind it was like a gunfight at the OK Corral kind of, this big scene where lots of kind of shooting was going on, and you'll never take me alive, and all that. And I think you make up kind of a better way that they captured him than the one that's actually on the DVD, if that makes sense.
Reality is often disappointing.
Yeah, I definitely agree that the story you make up in your own head is potentially more impressive than they could have shown.
Yes.
Yeah. At least we've lowered your expectations for when you eventually watch it. So as I said in the preamble, he Carpenter originally wrote the film between 1974 and 1976 as a reaction to the Watergate scandal, but no studio wanted to make it because it was deemed too dark and too violent. So what are your thoughts on that?
Compared to some other films that were made at the time, it's really not that violent. I mean, there is violence, but not explicit violence. I think there's only really one shot of any real gore when one of the crazies gets his hand blown off when he's escaping from the chock full of knots. I was kind of inspired by, if not the politics of, but the sort of the vibe of Death Wish.
Yes.
Which was, that was a violent film. It's interesting. I don't think it doesn't strike me as being that controversial.
Yeah, I wonder if some of that was like an excuse because it's very anti, government and anti-president. I wonder if some of that was like, we can't really, because it's too dark, because it's like, I compared to some of the things like you say around the time, I don't think it's too horrific. I mean, there's things like a head on a spike and stuff like that. But I don't think there's anything in there that a horror film around that time would have been. there is a kind of horror feel to it, and I noticed that last night more than anything when I was watching it again. You've got that they actually call them the crazies, don't they? Coming out of the down the streets and out of the kind of sewers and things like that. And then you've got this really kind of gothic thing where Adrian Barbeau walks down this set of stairs with this torch, like a lit kind of torch thing. It's a very, very kind of Dracula-esque. So I don't think there's anything in it that would be like, oh no, this is like too horrific for audiences. I wonder if it was used maybe as an excuse because of the political stuff and because of the government, anti-government message that it was, because it is both kind of like John Carpenter and Kurt Russell's stance, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yes. I think the only thing that kind of threw me a bit was the assault that seemed to be taking place in one of the rooms when I didn't recall that. Well, so whether that was cut from the TV version that I saw
it was cut from some versions, and that's the one part of the film that, well, it does make me uncomfortable. I understand the idea behind it. As you say, Snake is socially irredeemable. He's not a hero, so he sees that happening and he doesn't intervene. He doesn't, come to the rescue. He just carries on about his business. And I can see the point of that scene from that perspective. But that sort of thing in a film is always uncomfortable, which I guess is the point.
Yeah.
What do you guys think to the writing on this one? I mean, well, I'll come to you first, Paul. I mean, you're a writer yourself. I mean, how do you like or not Carpenter's approach here?
I think it's brilliant. I watched some of the documentaries as well. It's very much kind of, as well as that sort of horror, the gothic stuff and all the rest of it, it's a Western. And they say as much, you know, it's a Western. That's why, like, somebody mentioned Lee Van Cleef to come into, oh, he used to be in the old spaghetti Westerns. Let's get Lee Van Cleef into it. But it is very much that kind of structure of having to, like the searchers, having to find somebody, going into unknown territory, like dangerous territory, finding somebody. See, Star Wars again, it's going to find Princess Leia or, you know, anything like that. So you've got this very tight, suspenseful thing where he's thrown into this fish out of water kind of place. He is used to places like that, but not that exact place. So he doesn't really know where he's going or what he's doing. And it is very tight and it's quite suspenseful. And there are bits that are very kind of zombie-esque, where he's been, like I said, the people are rising up from the ground and, you know, attacking him. And it's like, is he going to get out of this? You just don't know. So I think, like, the writing of it just goes from one kind of set piece to the next set piece to the next. And it's like, you need to go here to get this clue. You need to go here to get, now we've got to go and see the Duke. And it's like, it's very tight. It's really kind of tight. And an hour and a half, that's what you want to be. You can't be messing about. You know, so as a right from a writing point of view, I just think it's top, you know, it's something that I would have liked to have written. So that's kind of you know, my highest praise anyway. It's like something that I wish I could have written, something like that, you know.
Cool. Nick?
Yeah, I completely agree with Paul, and it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of the Lee Van Cleef and the Western thing. I think there's a real sort of Sergio Leone influence on it, sort of the lone cowboy and going into that situation. But yeah, it's like a lot of the films at the time, and particularly Carpenter at the time, it is tight. It gets to the point and it moves from one thing to the next quite swiftly and quite logically, and you get to where you need to be. Doesn't really mess about, doesn't do a lot of, there is a certain amount of exposition, the introduction and narration, which I think was an uncredited Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
When you know that, you go, oh yeah, that's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
But it sort of sets the rules of the world right up front, and then lets you loosen it and lets Snake loosen it. So yeah, I really love it. I think it's very nicely done.
The other thing I meant to mention as well was the kind of Hitchcockian ticking, you know, time bomb sort of thing. Whereas you've got, like, it's normally you've just got one thing going on, and in this you've got, like, he's got to get that tape there, otherwise, you know, it's a nuclear war or whatever, and it's the end of the world and all the rest of it. But you've also got the personal stakes of him having to get back within that time, otherwise he dies. So you've got, like, two of these ticking things going on at the same time, which, you know, they sort of amplify a little bit in the second one, because he's got the kind of flu, hasn't he, the ramped up. So he's kind of like, he's almost like dying in real time. In the film, but whereas in this one, it is unless he gets back in a certain point, these little capsules kind of pop on the side of his, which would be horrific, wouldn't it? You know, yeah, that's good writing as well, because it's not just like one set of stakes. You've got, I mean, the global set of stakes, but you've also got a personal level set.
Yeah, especially that to the actual character himself, the global stakes just didn't matter at all. So I had to give him something personal, and it's the highest stakes of all, really.
Yeah, couldn't care less, could he?
I mean, the novelization, it adds a little kind of backstory to some of these elements touched upon in the movie. I mean, one of them was the bank robbery, which, you know, that we've just discussed. But it hints that the cassette that he's got with him, it's not exactly benevolent. I know Pleasance has stood up there at the end saying it could lead to peace and stuff. But it suggests, apparently, in the novel that it's a plan for a weapon of mass destruction, which you kind of pick up when he puts it on in the cab. So it comes across more as he was turning up to this meeting to issue a threat than anything else.
I did not get that.
No, I didn't.
It does also suggest that the nerve gases used in, at that point, World War III, it's gradually turning everyone in America crazy. And I'm not really going to comment on that one right now.
I'm
kind of interested to get hold of the novel, actually, because it does sound like it's got some really interesting backstory to it.
I mean, I was just going to say, as novelizations, you know, I'll be writing one in a not too distant future, you kind of like extrapolate things from a script that I don't, may or may not be in there. So I wonder whether that was the writer or whether that was the script, or do you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, where do you stand on canon when it comes to that? I mean, you said you're going to be writing a novelization yourself. So
yeah,
I presume that when you sit back, you like to look on it as canon to the story.
Yeah, I suppose so, up to a point, because a lot of it is kind of you giving backstory to things that didn't really have backstory. So it's like if you write just a novel like I've just done, you can give a backstory to a character and nobody's going to say a thing. But you give a backstory to a character in a film that people love, and you give the wrong backstory to that character, or you don't okay it or whatever it is, then you could be in a bit of a mess. So it depends, really, I suppose, whether it was in the script or whether it was hinted at heavily in the script. Yeah.
So, yeah, the name Snake Plissken, it was taken from a real person. When writing the screenplay, Carpenter struggled over assigning a memorable name, and a friend suggested using the name of someone he knew in high school who he described as a sort of tough guy who bore a large snake tattoo on his abdomen. His last name was Plissken and went by the nickname Snake.
No.
Yeah,
that's a bit close to home, isn't it?
It is. Carpenter said, anybody with a snake tattooed on them someplace, that's my kind of hero.
I mean, I'd be a little bit wary of that guy showing up on my doorstep with that.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if that guy is still around.
He did make him look very cool, so I suppose, you know, he can't really grumble, can he?
Yeah, so apparently AFCO, they approached Carpenter after obviously the success of Halloween and The Fog to make a film based on the novel that had acquired regarding the Philadelphia experiments. When Carpenter got stuck on that project, he proposed instead his idea for Escape from New York. AFCO liked that idea and greenlit it almost immediately. So, the Philadelphia Experiment, directed by Stuart Raffel and starring Michael Paré, Bobby DiCicco and Nancy Ellen, was released in 1984 and became a cult classic in its own right, though, no one near as beloved as this one. Mm. So, yeah, we've covered the writing. So with regards to the direction, what are your guys' thoughts on this one? And again, I'll come to you first, Paul.
I think it's kind of like very sort of, it feels very cinema verite. It feels like that somebody's gone out on the streets and just filmed it. I mean, very kind of carefully staged things, you know, that John Carpenter set up and everything, but it feels very rough and ready. And I think there's a skill to that as well, to make something look like it's, you know, like Cloverfield, that kind of thing, to make it look rough and ready when it's kind of like all been set up quite, you know, it feels like these people have gone out just filming this guy trying to get the president back. It very much kind of like camera work is like following Snake around, and you know, now he's doing this and pointed up at him getting climbing out of windows and stuff. I mean, I should also point out that Carpenter said that Nick Castle wrote a lot of the humorous bits in that, so he kind of like came in and some of the humorous bits that were in it are down to Nick Castle when we were talking about the writing of it. But yeah, in terms of direction, it feels like it just feels like somebody was following him around New York. I don't know if you feel the same way, Nick.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, actually. I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, but yeah, it's very much sort of like, you know, you're in real time. Here's what's happening to this guy now.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah, it's not 24 hours long or whatever, but, no. but yeah, I mean, it's classic 80s Carpenter, really. Mm. What I love about the direction is that, you know, as you said, DK, it was on a $6 million budget, which even in those days was not an enormous amount of money, certainly not for a blockbuster film. And he makes it look so much bigger.
Mm.
It feels bigger. It's not really a direction, but I'd have to give a real shout out to, I guess, the cinematographer, because the lighting is, it's a dark film. It's at night for a large part of it. But you can see so much. The lighting's really well done and it feels kind of natural. It's not like it's been lit like a set, but you can see a lot in there, which I guess at the time, the early 80s, it was not that easy to achieve.
Which, according to my IMDb, is Dean Cundey, who did the cinematography. So, yeah.
It's like you said, Paul, it does have that vibe of a horror movie.
Oh yeah.
And I'm specifically thinking of a couple. The one where Snake's there and he's just trying to get his bearings first of all, and you can see people running around in the background, and it's not like they're doing anything nefarious. It's involving Snake. It's just that they're trying to get on with their lives. And I love that. I love the where they're coming out of the ground. And there's one bit where Romero's got the president and he sees Maggie coming down that corridor towards him, and it's like a kind of long shot, and I think it's just shot really beautifully.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you do feel like, as Nick said, it's like everything's kind of feels bigger. Everything feels, you know, as you say, people are walking around in the background just doing, getting on with it. It feels like he's just been dropped into New York, and this is a high security, you know, place. The whole place is a high security. And I mean, even to the point of like that crashed plane that he comes across is like, wow, you know, it's like, it just feels as though you're following him in a real place with real stuff happening. And there's, you know, it takes a lot of effort for that to happen, I think, you know, in terms of a direction and everything else, and the, you know, set design and everything. It just takes a lot of effort to make it look like you've just gone out with a camera and filmed this, as in, like, you know, this is happening down the road from you, and you're just filming it.
With regards to, you know, St. Louis, it's a surrogate locale for New York. They'd had a major fire there in 77. According to Carpenter, it had just the right amount of emptiness in the downtown area and the right architecture. He said, so much of the city looks vacant and dead, which was perfect for our needs, since we couldn't use anything looking new or fresh. Yeah, and the production design team, they would regularly go to the junkyard each day and just bring a load of crap back, basically, and dump it on the sets.
Yeah. You know, there's a way of doing it that would have been overkill or not enough or whatever, but it just feels real. The whole thing feels like it's real. That thing, that's part of its charm, really.
Yeah. I mean, apparently it was a tough shoot. Obviously, they filmed most of it at night. And he said, we would finish shooting at 6 a.m. and I'd be going to sleep at 7 when the sun would be coming up. I'd wake up around 5 or 6, depending on whether or not we had dailies. And by the time I got going, the sun would be setting. So for about 2.5 months, I never saw daylight, which was really strange.
Yeah.
And apparently the entire shoot was plagued by mosquitoes. So,
oh,
God.
Oh, no.
I mean, I know it's a production design thing, but for the bridge, yeah, they bought the old Chain of Rocks bridge. It was no longer in use at the time, but he bought the entire bridge from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for $1. And then just
that's
returned
good
it
use
to,
of budget, yeah.
Yeah, after filming was completed. So yeah, they got their money's worth.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah.
So yeah, do you have any standouts with regards to the direction on this? Any scenes that you just think that's just perfect?
Some of the transitions are really good because, as you say, a lot of the exteriors were filmed in St. Louis, which stood in very well for New York. I think they did 2 days in actual New York, they said. And a lot of the interiors were in LA. The transitions from, some of the exteriors were in LA as well. There's the base where they sort of start off and the bus pulls up and where the wall is. And then they sort of pan up and go to darkness up further. And it's probably a map painting of New York and just sort of transitioning from one to the other, sort of believing that it's, you know, really happening in the same location.
Yeah. I love the scene in the wrestling, you know, in the arena there, because it just feels like, you know, gladiatorial combat brought to like modern day. It just feels and it's just filmed again. It's filmed like you're in there with him and he's being hit with the bat with the nails in it and stuff like that. And you just don't, one minute you think, God, he's gonna pulverize it, and then the next minute he's hitting him in the stomach, and then he's hitting the back of his head, and that's it, it's over. And then they start chanting Snake.
Yeah.
a very fickle crowd.
Yeah, to me is a great scene. And it's intercut with other scenes as well, so it feels like it's going on for ages.
Yeah.
And it's, like you say, it's sort of filmed very realistically. It's like it could have been WWF at the time, WWE.
Yeah. Well, I think he was a wrestler, wasn't he?
He was. Baker, yeah.
Or something, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you just feel as though he's been thrown in there with, like, David and Goliath. He's been thrown in there with this guy. And they're even saying, you know, the Duke comes to the little kind of podium there, like ancient Rome, and he's like, his head will be on a spike on my car tomorrow when we go into. And he's kind of looking, Snake's looking up at him going, oh, God, you know?
I think.
And he just. You don't feel like he's got a chance.
Yeah, I think a lot of the veracity of that scene is down to Oxbaker, was it?
Yeah.
I think he took it a little bit too seriously. Kurt Russell stuntman was in there, and I think he took a hit to the head. So Kurt Russell had to go into some scenes he wouldn't necessarily have been in because there was such a lump on the stuntman's head that it couldn't be disguised.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And the stuntman said, watch yourself out there. It was so, apparently really was going genuinely hard on, thought he was going to die.
Yeah, apparently he was going hard on Russell as well.
Yeah.
And Russell had to, like, kind of tap him in the groin to get him to stop.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. It's all there, isn't it? You can see that he is going hard on him. You can see he's just going to town on him. And it doesn't, that's probably why it doesn't feel like it's fake, because he's not.
He is genuinely afraid for his life.
Yeah. Wow. That's you know, doing it for your art, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Russell stated that this is his favourite of all his films, and Plissken is his favourite character that he's played. Although originally executives wanted Tommy Lee Jones for the role, they didn't think Kurt Russell was right based on his prior work, although he did pitch himself hard because he was very keen to shake off his Disney image. Yeah, Carpenter fought for him, eventually got it, and apparently he decided to wear the eye patch at the last second before shooting. He didn't tell Carpenter beforehand, but Carpenter liked the look, so they just kept it.
I wonder if that was a nod to, is it True Grit, where John Wayne's got the eye patch?
Rooster,
I'm just thinking about Westerns again, because he does a very good Clint Eastwood impression.
Yeah.
Russell all the way through. I just wondered if the eye patch was a kind of John Wayne nod at all, because I know he's a fan of he's been in, like, he was in a TV show that was a Western as well in the 70s. So he's a fan of the genre, Kurt Russell.
I mean, take this with a pinch of salt, but allegedly one night while shooting, while Russell was in costume, they encountered some local thugs. He'd unwittingly strayed into their territory, but they were so intimidated by the way he looked, they didn't give him any trouble.
I like to believe that's true, and I can believe that's true.
Yeah, so can I.
So, yeah, with regards to the acting, how do you feel this holds up? I mean, do you think, personally, obviously, I do think he shook that Disney image, and he is literally one of the coolest guys out there now, I think.
Yeah.
In general, for the acting, I there's not a poor performance in the film. Every one of the main characters is just note perfect. But yeah, you got to give props to Kurt for Snake Plissken. He's become considering he's only been in two films and one of them came like 15 years later. He is iconic, and yeah, he took a lot of things from a lot of places. Obviously Lee Van Cleef's in the film, you can see a younger Lee Van Cleef playing that part. And again, there's, I guess, the sort of Western influence coming into it. But Kurt Russell did well with this and shed any image he might have had before that, which is difficult to think of now.
Yeah.
You know, we know Kurt Russell as he is now. And primarily, you know, when I think of Kurt Russell, I think of, well, I will go to Jack Burton from Big Trouble every time, but
yeah.
Escape from New York is the real famous one.
I was just going to say, everybody in it, as you say, just gives their all. I mean, Ernest Borgnine, when he sat there watching the kind of like show in front of him, the glee on his face is just like a childlike glee. Donald Pleasence at the end when he just loses it, you know, it's Adrian's face when, you know, Harry Dean Stanton gets blown up. It's just everything is like, all the emotion is there on the screen. It's, you know, they just give it their all, don't they?
There are so many good kind of character actors in this. Cabby was written with Ernest Borgnine in mind. Same with Maggie. for Adrian Barbeau.
Yeah.
And I just get such a feeling of joy whenever I see Ernest Borgnine in a film.
Yes.
There's not, as you both say, there's not a bad performance in this. You know, we've got Lee Van Cleef, we've got Harry Dean Stanton, we've got Tom Atkins, who's just a legend on this show, and we've got Tom Atkins' mustache.
Yeah. Absolutely. Has to get a mention.
Yeah.
We love Tom Atkins' mustache on this show. And if we could get an interview with Tom, we would, because
genuinely one of the nicest people I've ever met, Tom Atkins. We met him at a convention once, and he is genuinely lovely, you know.
Oh wow.
Adrienne as well, we met her at the same convention. Man. Just really nice people all together. I've got a shout out to Frank Doubleday as well, because the Joker, isn't it? I mean, he's just mad as soon as you see him. The way he struts around and he's dangerous, but kind of like comical, if that makes sense.
I love the way when the Duke tells Brain to just stay there and I'll deal with him later. Yeah. And Romero just points.
Yes.
He walks away as if to say, you're in for it.
Yeah, you're done. And you just know that when they walk into that room and all the stuff that's been done to the president, you can just sort of, you don't want to imagine it, but you can imagine it when he's got the wig on and everything. He's like, you don't really want to be left alone with this guy. With Romero.
Definitely not.
Complete. That performance was just insane. Literally insane.
Yeah.
And I've got to get, I mean, we do have to give a shout out to Donald Pleasance, who apparently he drew on his own wartime experiences as a POW for his performance. According to Carpenter, Pleasance was feeling kind of self-conscious about his accent. So he suggested that the script include a backstory to explain it, as the idea of the US had rejoined the British Empire because things had fallen apart to such an extent. Mm-hmm. So in which case the president no longer need to be a natural born citizen. And Carpenter thought it was interesting, but he thought it'd be distracting, so he just chose to simply ignore it. Yeah, apparently the role was pitched to him as the love child of Reagan and Thatcher.
That's a nightmarish thing, isn't it?
Considering that the high caliber of performances in this, I mean, is there a standout for you with regards to, I think I know what everybody's going to say, but you know, is there an MVP in this one?
The obvious answer is, of course, Kurt Russell. But I my MVP is, to be honest, it's Adrienne Barbeau. The way she plays the scenes just on her face is just masterful. She's excellent throughout, but particularly that scene at the end on the bridge, the 1-2 between her and Snake, and just the look on her face. She just puts it all out there. You can tell exactly what she feels. And, you know, as she goes to sacrifice herself and get revenge at the same time. Yeah, it's just masterfully done for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, if I can't have Kurt, or, you know, Kurt's the automatic knee-jerk reaction. I'll go Harry Dean Stanton then, because I just think he gives good squirm. He's just like, I swear to God, you know, don't kill me, because I know this, and I know how to get across the bridge. And he's
just a survivor.
He's literally the brains of the outfit. He's come up with the you know, petrol for the cars and stuff, and figured out how to get across the bridge and everything. And it's just, you know, you wouldn't put those two together, Adrienne and Harry, in a kind of relationship, but there's a genuine love there. You can see it's, you know, although the Duke has kind of ordered her to go there, you can see there's genuine affection.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, the way he plays it is like, he's a guy you wouldn't trust, but also at the same time, you can see why that relationship happened. You can see why she loves him. Yeah. So, yeah, I'll go. Yeah, those two. So we've made a couple, really, haven't we?
Yeah, and I think they do play off against each other very well. And like you say, there is genuine affection between them, and you can see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
See, yeah. I can't say Russell now because I don't want to be the basic bitch.
So, I mean, he's the given. So now we're going, if it's not Kurt, then who? Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go with Pleasance. Accent aside, he's got this duality to him that's really kind of sometimes, I mean, you can kind of feel sorry for him at times, but other times he just turns on a dime into this cold bastard. And I like how he plays that.
It's the way he says it all in that kind of really soft voice as well. Like when he gets in the pod at the start and he's like, "And God save all of you as well." And he knows they're going to crash into, he knows they're all dead.
Yeah.
And the same thing at the end when Snake says to him, "A lot of people die trying to get there. How do you feel about that?" And he's like, "I want to thank them too." And you can't, they're all dead. But he doesn't give a toss about any of those people. No. And you can see that.
And it's plain that once he's answered Snake's questions, he just sees him as an annoyance.
Yeah. Yes. I've got 2 minutes, so get out.
Yeah.
I think maybe we ought to mention Isaac Hayes as well, because, I mean, you know, he gives a very, it's very understated, but the menace in his kind of, the Emperor thing's going on as well, and just he could make people wither with a look, you know. It's just,
he does give a really good performance, and it's somewhat, it's a shame that he's most notable to like newer generations as the voice from South Park, but I think he's really menacing in that role.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you don't know which way he's going to go next. I mean, when I was talking about like Harry Dean Stanton squirming, that's why he's squirming, because he doesn't know at any given time whether the Duke's just going to lop his head off.
Exactly. Yeah. And that wonderful scene where he's shooting at Pleasance with Snake's gun.
Yeah.
I thought he made a really good impression for what's relatively limited screen time for arguably the villain. You know, I think there's several villains in this film, but it's Isaac Hayes, isn't it? And anybody who rolls up in a car with a couple of chandeliers on the front and a mirrorball hanging from it, you know, you're dealing with somebody who doesn't mess around.
So moving on now to special effects production design, was there anything that stood out for you as regards to the effects?
I think they stand up pretty well. There's some matte paintings in there. There's some model work, but the real standout for me is the wireframe when he's on the glider.
Yeah.
Looks fantastic. I think it stands up now. I mean, admittedly, we'd have, even in 1997, they'd have probably had something better than a wireframe, but the actual way they did that effect was to construct a model of New York out of cardboard boxes painted black with bright green lines on the edges.
Yeah.
Which is just astonishing to me, because I think they did quite well for the computer effects in 1981, and it's cardboard boxes with like green paint on, or green tape.
I don't. You mentioned the matte paintings, didn't you? And I'm pretty sure I heard this, and I think I heard it the first time on, do you remember Movie Drone that used to be on Sunday night that James Cameron did some of those matte paintings when he used to work for some of those kind of scene, the kind of landscapey scenes and things, that's what he was doing, James Cameron. So I was just going to say, it's that kind of thing of like the future, it's set in the future, it's a bit like a future, but it's kind of going backwards, or it's set in one kind of time that's made like really decayed. So it is kind of timeless quality. Like, so you can look back on it now where we are and say, you know, that's still it's still futuristic. It's still, apart from that robot in the bit that they cut off, it still all works pretty well, I think, as a future. Without those dates there, you could just change those dates from 1997, from 1988 to like 2030 or 2040 something. You know, you could just still put it in the future. It still holds up, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's nothing too extravagant there that doesn't age badly, as you said, other than the little robot. weirdly enough, the model of the city that you were talking about, Nick, it was later repainted and reused for Blade Runner.
Hmm. Wow.
So that's a bit of a glow up.
It is a little bit, yeah. Yeah.
So I think the special effects are. I like that it doesn't overly rely on special effects, and it comes more down to the story and acting on this one. And I think that's part of the reason, because when you compare this, and you know, it's obviously going to come up, when you compare this one to the sequel, one's aged a lot better than the other.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I don't have a lot of, anything for the sequel, I guess. I did see it at the cinema. I did see that one at the cinema. I don't remember a lot about it, but I do remember, you know, not being impressed with the special effects in it.
You weren't blown away by the surfing?
It was the surfing I was thinking of specifically as well. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I wasn't, I'm afraid.
Well, I watched it because I knew I was coming on here, and I think I knew that was going to come up, so I watched it after, you know, watched it a couple of weeks ago. I think you're right. I mean, the CG just really hasn't. It just looks cartoony. I think there's a good idea in there. I think, like, taking it to LA and making it about, you know, Mickey take of the films and plastic surgery and, you know, the shark coming out. I just don't think the special effects and everything was there enough to do it.
Yeah.
And they were going to make a sequel to that, weren't they? Escape from
Earth. I was just thinking of that, Escape from Earth or something.
Escape from Earth, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So, I mean, Carpenter says he's not yet given up on it.
Really?
Though, you know, I will admit that time is ticking.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been talk of a remake for a few years, but it seems to be perpetually stuck in development hell. And in one of them, they approached Wyatt Russell to play Snake, but he turned it down by saying such a thing would be career suicide. I mean, I don't get that, because it didn't sound as bad for his father.
It might be the comparisons to
the original. But I was very conscious last night while watching this, just how much Wyatt looks like Kurt. It's scary in some. The latest attempt, it's apparently being looked at by Radio Silence, who were responsible for things like Ready or Not and the last couple of Scream movies.
Oh, okay, right.
And they've now said it's to be a sequel rather than a remake.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've not touched upon with regards to this is the sound design and the score. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's one of the all-time classics. John Carpenter is, when he's on fire with regards to soundtracks, he's on fire, and this is one of his most famous.
I think I said something similar in the other John Carpenter ones I've been on, but it's a classic John Carpenter synth score from the 80s. I mean, the man knew how to build tension and build up to that climax and just go wild at the end.
It's sublime.
Yeah. I mean, I had the CD. You were talking about all the themes and all the kind of like music from various things. I had the CD that the films of John Carpenter. Not only are they good soundtracks and you're watching the film and it fits the film, but you could be listening to it and working on something or whatever it is, or let's just listen to it with your earphones in, and you're tapping they're just good themes. They're just, you know, very catchy tunes. Yeah, it's just a great soundtrack, really.
So yeah, going back to the legacy, we touched upon like the sequels and possible reboots. There was at one point going to be an anime based on the movie, which was going to be executive produced by Carpenter, but that fell through, as did a planned video game that was in development from 2005 to 2007, but that was ultimately cancelled. The only thing that's been relatively successful with regards to follow-up media, not including the merchandising aspects. There have been a series of comic books based on The Adventures of Snake Plissken, which has been produced by Marvel, Hurricane Entertainment, and Boom Studios, respectively, which saw Snake interact with characters such as Captain Ron, and if you know, you know, although it's not that one. And weirdly enough, and it is that one, Jack Burton. Is a crossover between Big Trouble in Little China and Escape from New York. I have
heaven.
No idea.
Absolute heaven.
Yeah, I have no idea how that would bizarre. Work, but I really want to track down a copy and see.
That sounds really odd.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Escape from New York video game may have been cancelled, but video game director Hideo Kojima has referred to the movie frequently as an influence on his work, in particular the Metal Gear series. Solid Snake is partially influenced by Snake Plissken. And in Metal Gear Solid 2, Sons of Liberty, Snake uses the alias Plissken to hide his real identity during most of the game. So yeah, as you can see, while the movie came out in 81, the passion for these things, they can take on a life of their own and inspire others all these years later. And speaking of which, I mean, we know it's a cult classic, but is it a personal classic to you? I'll say yeah. What about you guys?
It's Escape from New York. It's Kurt Russell. It's John Carpenter. It's Snake Plissken. It's all those things. And yeah, it just transcends. Yeah, I guess for me. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite thing about it, about this film?
I am going to go with Kurt this time.
Fair enough.
Yeah. He's an iconic character, and he's socially irredeemable, but it's a world filled with bad people, and it takes the most badass, doesn't give a shit character to actually save the day.
Cool. Yeah. Paul?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic as far as I'm concerned, and I find myself going back, and the more I think about my own stuff, the more I can see characters like Snake Plissken in certain, you know, you can see like mixtures of like Nick Skinner is a bit of a kind of like, I've got to get through this, I've got to go through. I mean, in Luna, he's being chased by the kind of like things with white eyes, and they look a bit, there's scenes that look a bit like Escape from New York, and you just think, you look back and you think, yeah, that's where I got that from. And Peel in the third Red novel, I had to do like a special edition of that, and I had to sketch the characters. And I sketched, and I look back at the sketch, and I kind of, when I've done it, and I look back at it, and he's got an eye patch, and he's got a beard. He's got a beard and a cowboy sort of hat, right, which is a mixture of The Thing and Snake Plissken. And he's got an axe, which is also Conan the Barbarian. So he's in a post-apocalyptic world fighting werewolves. So it's like, yeah, this stuff, you know, it all gets mishmashed in your brain, and things that you watch when you were young end up in your own work, and certain like scenes and certain characters. So he's a classic as far as I'm concerned, and you know, it's crept into my work quite a bit, I think.
Yeah, I've got to say this is a personal classic, and I don't know about you guys, but everything about it is just so freaking cool. At the end of the day, I just the aesthetic, all of it, I just love it.
Yeah, you could look at it as a relatively minor blip on the cinematic universe, being it's like a film from 1981, one sequel, you know, as you've said, DK, there's been various sort of other media around it, but the influence of it, and admittedly, you know, it owes a lot of influence to other things like the Westerns, as you said, Paul, and other things. But it's a classic anti-hero archetype, I guess. But it's very iconic for me, Snake Plissken.
Yeah, I agree. Totally.
Cool. So, if you've been a regular these past seasons, you'll know we always ask you for your input on these things. And as usual, this being a Carpenter movie, we had a fair bit. So we'll head on over to our resident mailbox explorer, Vianne, to see what you said. So, Happy New Year, Vianne. What's the verdict on this one for our season opener?
Yeah, lots of feedback on this one. Amir Mohammed Zadeh, I hope I said that right, Amir. He says, I really like Escape from L.A., in which Carpenter and Russell said, fuck it, let's do a parody of New York. David Myers says, this one's a very special memory for me. I bought it unseen on CED, if anyone remembers those. I don't. Based on my friend's recommendations. Took it home, making it the first R-rated movie to enter the household. That is a very special distinction. Fortunately, my parents loved the movie as I did. Since the dreaded R rating has been breached, my dad then introduced me to The Godfather, but he counted every swear word in it. Gareth Brown says, proper entertainment from an era that's never coming back. I agree with you, Gareth. R.I.P. old filmmaking. It's a very different world we're living in. Let's see. Mark Westy calls it a masterpiece. John Mayer, good but overrated. To which Jeremy Taylor responded, I absolutely loved it growing up. I still like it, but now what I thought was an amazing blockbuster is actually a cheaply made, low-budget, barely-acted affair. The novel is way better and includes the big chunk of meth that Snake keeps munching on during the mission. So kind of interesting perspective how time and age, you know, and going back and looking at something you haven't seen in a while can really change your perception of it. Darren Linder says, it's my favorite John Carpenter film and soundtrack. Always has been. Seeing Kurt Russell do his best Clint Eastwood impression while across the table from Lee Van Cleef is amazing. Paul Wildon, indifferent. He gives us the okay sign a couple of times. Michael Andrews, however, says that it's one of his all-time favorite action movies. David Flack is also indifferent, though. It could have been worse and could have been better, he says. It is far better than Escape to L.A. So, let's see. Friend Cult Cinema and TV, Al Winter. Love it. One of my earliest VHS memories. Also really love the sequel and even prefer it in some ways. So there's some pretty highs and lows going here. Some very contradictory opinions. Ben Tissor, Kurt's Clint imitation, the feel of the film, the amazing soundtrack. I could watch this on a loop and not get tired. High praise indeed. Evan Popplestone, a John Carpenter classic. I noticed that not a single woman has chimed in on this one. So I'd love to hear some feedback from ladies because some of us do enjoy a good action film. Jim Boyke says he loves it. One of my all-time favorite movies, first R-rated film I saw in theater. Ah, noticing a theme here, people's first introduction to the R rating. He says, my mom took me and my brother. She told my dad she really enjoyed it also. Snake Plissken is my favorite movie character. So yeah, people seem to really have fond memories of it, whether it's for the cheesy aspect, the soundtrack, what have you. My dog has things to say about it. So anyway, with that, back to you, DK.
Yeah, great stuff. Thanks for that, Vian. So, yeah, it's as if you haven't guessed already, what about us? It's time to find out what we here in the studio think. And again, if you've been with us for a while, you'll know how this operates. And if you're joining us for the first time, well, in that case, welcome. And don't worry, you'll soon pick this one up. So, yeah, I'm going to come to you first on this one, Paul. What score would you give this out of 5 and why?
Out of 5, probably about 10. It would be 5 out of 5. Just it ticks all my boxes. You know, it's a intelligent action film. As I say, an hour and a half, and it doesn't hang about. It doesn't outstay its welcome. Fantastic performances, and as Nick said, an iconic, you know, anti-hero. Who's actually got his own moral code. You know, he's not just doing things for the sake of it. He's actually he's got his own kind of moral code, however grey that might be. But it just ticks all of my boxes, really.
Cool, Nick.
I'm going to give it a 4.5. The only reason it doesn't get the full 5 from me is it's not Big Trouble in Little China, which is my all-time favourite. But yeah, it's classic 80s John Carpenter, Kurt Russell. Tightly scripted, as Paul said, gets from A to B. Not a bad performance in it. Classic score, just fantastic stuff. Everybody having a pretty good time with their role, and that follows through and just gives the audience a really good time.
Cool. I'm probably going to get crucified for this. I'm going to give it 4. It's a little dated in some aspects, and again, I'm thinking of the robot, even though it wasn't in the final film. But it's just there. It is scarily prescient in others. It's iconic for a reason. It single-handedly gave us both the character of Snake Plissken, and in the same blow, confirmed Kurt Russell to be one of the coolest people alive. And that's the word I'd use to describe this. It may be a personal thing, but everything about it just feels cool. I feel cool watching it. It's weird how the mind plays tricks, as it's a tad slower than I remember it being, but it's got some great set pieces. It's filled with fantastic character actors playing memorable roles, features an amazing Carpenter soundtrack that's instantly recognizable to this day. And then there's his other work behind the camera, the writing, the direction. It's gritty, but it's not dour, even with the subject matter. It's effortlessly atmospheric. And watching it always gives me, the vibe of looking through an early 80s video rental store and seeing the innumerable low-budget knockoffs of this type of movie. But honestly, none of them really hold a candle to this one. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on it, which, putting the scores together, gives Escape from New York a final cult classic score of 4.5 out of 5, which, I mean, it's pretty much nail on head for you there, Nick. So you must be feeling pretty chuffed about it.
Yeah. I called it.
Yeah.
Not quite perfect, but pretty close to it. Great. So, yeah, those are our thoughts. And if you want to chime in or chastise us for getting it wrong, as always, our socials are open for you to vent. We look forward to hearing from you. As for today, all that remains is to thank my guest on this inaugural 2025 episode. Cheers for joining us on this one, Nick. Hopefully it will be an easy one to edit.
I'll have to listen to myself more than I would like, but yeah, I hope so.
Nice. And to you, Paul, thank you for joining us on this one. I hope you've had as much fun as you did last time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking me. I did. Yeah, I have lots of fun on it.
Awesome. Well, you're always welcome on the show. Have you got anything in particular you'd like our listeners to look out for? Any links, any social media, that kind of thing?
Just my website, really. I'm on all the socials, just under my own name. But shadow-writer.co.uk. That's my website. And then anywhere else, I'm on all the different, so whatever they're called these days. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on Facebook. I'm on X, as it is at the moment. Just do a search for me and you'll get me anyway.
No worries. I mean, just like last time, we'll put the links to your stuff in the description.
Oh, thank you.
If you're listening out there and you'd like to check out Paul's work and where to buy his novels, please check those out. And, you know, while you're there, check out the description and check out those earlier episodes, either the one with Paul for Hellraiser or the one with Nick on the other Carpenter ones. So, yeah, that's it for us on the first episode of this season. While Nick heads off to work his magic, I'll thank you out there for joining us. If you've enjoyed it, then please don't forget to like, subscribe and spread the word. We'll be back, as always, first Tuesday of next month with a new episode featuring a special guest / silver screen virgin as we take a look at another cult classic. And yeah, we may have a surprise for you on that one, you lucky people. I won't tell you what it is, only to say that if you like your 80s movies, especially of the cheesy sci-fi horror variety, then make sure you subscribe. Until then, take care of yourself. Never give in to those fascists. And if you enjoyed Escape from New York, watch out for the live version coming to an American city near you. I'll see you next time. And remember, get a new president.
You've been listening to the Cult Classic Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Editing by Nick. Produced by Mike Wilson. Feedback section produced by Lady Vienne. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This has been a Mad Badger production for the Media Matters Podcast Network. Copyright 2024. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.